Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 95, where we will discuss Tom Lupton's famous ethnography, On the Shop Floor, Two Studies of Workshop Organization and Output, originally published in 1963 by Pergamon Press. This is part one of the episode where we will examine the two cases presented in the text and the research question into why worker production always fell short of management expectations, despite being offered all the right incentives. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi there. My name's Miranda, and I am based in Leamington Spa.
And I'm Tom. I'm calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And I'm Greta, calling in from Windsor in the UK. Today we're discussing the book On the Shop Floor that's written by Tom Lupton. And this book is part of a series of monographs on the social and behavioral sciences. And the subtitle of the book is Two Studies of Workshop Organization and Output. And I'm very excited that we're discussing this book. It's one of the real classics, but also one of the perhaps forgotten or undervalued classics in organization studies, in the sense that it's a classic example of ethnographies in the workplace. And here, Tom Lupton is studying garment factories and how garments are produced in Manchester, I believe, in the UK, and really being part of the workforce to study how the work is being done, how management is exercising control, and why the work and the performance of the workers is what it is, and what factors, what social factors are shaping the way work gets done on the work floor. So as a sociologist studying organizations and studying how work gets done, I was super excited finding this book. It got recommended to me by Steve Barley, who is also a well-known ethnographer in our field. And I do see how this is one of the foundational books establishing the tradition of doing ethnography inside organizations. And Tom Lupton was actually, at the time, he was, I believe, an anthropology PhD student when he carried out this research. So perhaps, doing ethnographic fieldwork in organizations was not yet a common practice in management research, but definitely, anthropologists were interested in not only, studying the exotic tribes in Africa or wherever in the world, but also deploying their methods and their toolkits to understand key questions around management inside organizations.
Yeah, thanks, Greta. And you're right. This is kind of a forgotten text. It's extremely hard to find. And it's surprising that it is, because it is such a classic. But it's hard to find. And I think part of that is because Lupton, I guess, as his name has not been as well renowned as some of the others. A lot of the other works that have been a little bit more renowned, like from the Carnegie Mellon School and from some of the others, there's a lot of names associated in organizational sociology that is just simply carried forward. And because Lupton's is not as well renowned, his books have not gone through the same level of reprints and updates and whatever. And we actually struggled to find copies to be able to get it. I had to get mine from California. It just isn't as out there. So we're hoping that we can discuss this and bring it a little bit more to the fore, because it's a fascinating case study. Not only is it an ethnography, it's also a good study of or a good case of participant observation, which we covered in episode 38 on police socialization, where the investigator is actually a part of the organization that he or she is studying. And in this case, there were two case studies, one in the Y Garment Factory and one in Jay's Electrical Components, two different cases where he actually was a worker on the shop floor observing behavior. And it wasn't so much covert the way that Van Manen was in the police socialization. I think there was greater knowledge that Lupton was on the floor as a participant, observer, investigator. But the intimate details that that he brings out in talking about the cases is what makes this book so striking. It's not the sort of intimate details that you would naturally see in other publications. And in doing so, he brings out some very important findings and justifies them concerning how the tensions between workers and management and how the workers exercised internal controls over shop behavior.
So I agree with you, Tom. And I think in the podcast, we now have a series of ethnographies we discuss that have been conducted inside organizations and that we could say belong to the classic. So we have the Dalton episode, I think one of the first episodes on workers playing games on the work floor to make their work less boring is another one. And I do believe this book should be a standard reading for any doctoral student in management or perhaps someone that is starting an MBA. So I very much encourage the current publisher owning the copyright of this book to make a digital ebook version available so it can be read more widely.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the beginning of the book because I thought it was really interesting to see how the problem was identified and fleshed out. And I thought from a methodological point of view of how do you frame research, it was absolutely really well done. So what I'm referring to is those initial chapters where actually the author describes a little bit of their background, I think an apprenticeship or like a sort of experience as a when he was younger, looking within what was happening in that work setting. And I thought the other really interesting point was actually how already from the start there was this identification of sort of the control aspect as a possible explanation. And it was already setting this piece of research aside from like the Hawthorne experiments. And I can't remember the other works that he was referring to. And I thought that was a really great way of just building into a little bit of the research scholarship, but also putting at the forefront the case study and the ethnography.
Definitely. And I think you referred to his apprenticeship as a marine engineer in the 30s that pretty much shaped Tom Lupton's approach to understanding what are the factors that are shaping the behavior on the shop floor, as he calls the work floor inside factories. And I really enjoyed like some of his experiences he describes on page 2 of the book, where he mentions that when he was doing his apprenticeship, he got a task assigned that kind of was, he was completely absorbed in it. And so he forgot the time and he got completely disturbed by the buzzer going off announcing the end of the workday. And then when he was packing up his stuff, his colleagues were looking so annoyed to him, like he had clearly violated some of the informal rules on the work floor and being, you know, overeager to perform the work, and the culture on that shop floor was clearly he was deviating from some of the norms. And yeah, I also saw like how those early experiences that he had early in his work life shaped his I would say as well as his training, that, you know, the way work gets done is not just determined by rules, formal rules set by management, but also like the informal rules in communities and societies, and that we have to understand the relations between people and the rules governing those relations to understand, you know, what is at play when work is being done.
And it's also worth mentioning that, you know, why he brought in, say, the Hawthorne studies, because in a way, these case studies were geared towards challenging a couple of the assumptions or some of the findings that came from that concerning what causes workers to operate below the levels, below the maximum level that they can. I think he was concerned that the explanation that, that the incentive structure should like greater incentives for harder work should result in harder work was not holding. It wasn't holding in his personal experience. And it wasn't, you know, is this really the case? Is this sort of assumptions hold? Well, it turned out as he underwent these case studies, he found that they didn't hold, that there were other factors. There were these informal norms that artificially interfered. I guess interfered would be a way to put it. with the worker's desires or necessity of working at maximum efficiency. So it's interesting. Now, the question is, does the case studies really show that? And I guess we can just sort of go in and give a little bit more about the case studies, the Y Garmin factory and Jay's Electrical Components. Either one of you two wanted to cover that?
Before,
or do you want me to?
Before that, I wanted to just highlight another really peculiar aspect of this book, that he really gives an authentic view of the people and of the environment. Like, it really feels that you actually know when you've read it what it was like to work there. And I thought that was really, it made it an enjoyable read, regardless of if you agree or disagree and how it was constructed. It made it come to life.
Certainly made it less dense. It was a quick read. It was a comfortable read. So the first case study is of the Y Garmin company. The company designs and produces weatherproof gear, weatherproof clothing. And he worked in a shop, basically one of the units with about 15 to 20 workers. It was one of those things where the work was kind of seasonal and in some ways irregular. They were occasionally having to switch styles, switch batches of types of clothing. And I think an important part of the cases was about the incentive scheme, where depending on which type of garment we're talking about determined what was paid to whom. And this is a case where the garments flowed from one worker to one set of workers to another set of workers for different parts of assembly. And there was, so you had folks who did the sleeves, you had folks who did the backs, you had folks who did the buttonholes and buttons and things like that. So it was sort of pieced that way.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's on page 35 that he gives a little bit of a personal reflection or autoethnographic account of what work in the factory was like. And he describes the work itself as tedious and boring. Sometimes he would work for weeks doing the same thing all day, every day. He is saying that, you know, standing all day doing the work was physically really exhausting for him. But before, he's also describing that most of the workers in his team, in his department, were women. And working class women, often from, you know, challenging circumstances, like, let's put it like that, financially. So they were kind of accustomed to some hardship. And these women were also laughing at Tom for being such a sissy that he was not used to doing physical labor. I found it really funny. But he found the work hard, exhausting, difficult to adjust himself to the job. And he also said that the standards of what outputs had to be could reasonably be expected that were set by management. He said these standards have been derived at based upon the technical abilities of the, you know, the way they set up the work. But for him, it was often challenging to meet those minimum standards himself. And what I enjoyed throughout reading the book is also like how he talks about the social contract of the willingness of workers to do a good job, but also expecting to you know, make an earnest wage for the work that they do, and how in the situations where, you know, a conflict emerged.
You're absolutely right, Greta. And I think the power of the book is that he situates the reader where he was sitting, and he showed that, you know, he made his own mistakes and admitted to them and presented his own perspective in a way that you could trust what he was saying.
Yeah, and I think one thing to add is that what I really liked about this book is how in-depth Tom Lupton is going into the nature of the work that's being done, the production of the garments, but also how the production of the garment is structured inside the organization, inside the factory. So he mentions these three work groups and he was embedded in one of them. And I believe there were 18 workers in his group or in his team, I could say. And so some of the work could happen in parallel, like, you know, one worker could sew the sleeves, another could be working on the front, another on the back. But then also, you know, all the parts of the jacket had to be integrated in one jacket. So that was linear. And while the person that had to sew everything together was dependent on the simultaneous delivery of the other finished parts, the workers were pretty much independently rewarded for their productivity. So this I found, like, you know, and how he goes in depth about, like, you know, the ideas that management had about performance and how they restructured the way the team was operating and the layout of the work floor. But then all these complex interdependencies, I found very striking. And, you know, immediately I thought, like, you know, this independent reward scheme is never going to work. Like, you know, it's encouraging competition. It's not encouraging collaboration. And, you know, later on in the book, he has an entire chapter dedicated to that.
Yeah, and I found it very interesting, the idea of piece-by-piece payment or incentive schemes. I guess, you know, I entered the workforce somewhat later than this, and by the time I spent a couple summers in the factory, most of the ones around where I'm at was just flat rate. You know, you get an hourly wage, it's not like, for example, in this factory, and also in Jay's, in the case we'll cover later, where the pay is dependent upon how many pieces, what type of pieces, what type of role. It seems like an incredibly complex system, but I guess it makes sense, and Lupton shows that it makes sense in the first chapter. The pay scheme is designed by management to try to make the maximum use of the time. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to incentivize work to move along the pipeline faster because, you know, to be able to get the outputs faster, but try to, instead of like paying everybody just a flat rate and saying, you know, just work until, you know, from morning to end, it's trying to ensure that in some way that the harder jobs get more money, the jobs that have particular direct impact on the output, like the ones who do the finishing at the end, are incentivized to try. And they try to make it per piece, per style, or per something. You know, basically the output determines what was going to be paid. Lots of bonuses. And I couldn't necessarily follow all of the bonus incentive schemes. It was very complicated.
I'll be honest, as someone who hasn't sort of worked in a factory before, I was pretty surprised by this sort of payment scheme, and I was very intrigued by it. And it didn't really make much sense to me at the beginning. But I think what actually kind of I felt wasn't explained enough was this concept of absenteeism of the workers. So it seemed to have been very much relegated or defined by the fact that they were women. They were women that were there not as sole breadwinners, but as people who were supporting the family. So my question maybe is, are these fluctuations in presences actually due to the fact that they had other things going on, which seems to be suggested by the book, or actually is it also tied to this tricky to understand bonus and payment scheme where maybe they had achieved what they wanted within the month and therefore then they were absent? It seemed a little bit difficult for me to sort of get my head around.
I'm not sure that Tom Lupton knew 100% either. And this is, maybe this is a limitation of being a participant observer, that he was, as much as he went through person by person, and he did a full, well, he devoted like about a half page to each other member of unit talking about their particular circumstance. And it seemed like there was a combination of factors that weighed in absenteeism. Some of them were personal because of the needs outside of the workplace that they could not control. And then there were other cases where it seemed like absenteeism was about the only real measure of protest that the workers had in some cases. You know, and this kind of gets into what was Lipton really researching? And he was researching, you know, factors that cause workers to work less than 100% capacity at all times. And some of it stemmed from just natural antagonism between workers and management, and that the workers in some ways were expecting management to have things planned out in such a way where the workers' time could be reasonably maximized, that you didn't have hiccups that resulted in work piling up on some places whereas other workers weren't doing anything or whatever. And so then protests such as absenteeism would be a way of voicing displeasure or just getting out of the factory to clear their head for a bit. And I think that it's... What Lupton found in that case was that, you know, everybody's sort of feeling these pressures and these, and they're all affected by this management lack of planning. And yet in the Y Garmin case, they weren't coming together for collective action against it either. All of these protests were generally at an individual basis, and he was struggling to figure out why was that the case. You know, they would have had perfect opportunity to say, all right, we've had enough, let's go on strike, or, you know, whatever. But there was nothing, none of that happening.
Yeah, that sounds good. Like, another thing we could tap into is how that absenteeism also shows that there are factors influencing how work is being performed that is outside the control of either the worker or the manager. I mean, that was one of the big conclusions that Lupton also drew in his study. Like, you cannot control everything.
Yeah, and he indicated in the study that just because management can't control everything doesn't mean that they won't try.
It's interesting to read your take on it, Tom. But what struck me here was also the connection with the work that Judy Weissman has been doing about, you know, female managers, comparing female management with male management, and the factors that are shaping how work is getting done. And, you know, one of the conclusions that Tom Lupton draws in his study is that not all the social factors shaping performance at work and how work gets done is under the control of either management or the worker. So there might be some voluntary absenteeism, which is like intentional. But if you look at the workforce, which predominantly comprised female workers, it was Tom and one other male worker in his unit that were male. And a lot of these women, they had caring responsibilities, either for their children or for their elderly. I remember one of the female workers had a heavily disabled mom she was taking care of. You know, positioning this study in the context in which it took place, where women were considered being providing a supplementary income. What we see is, you know, for quite a few women in this unit, it was their key source of income. They had nothing to fall back on. And so when things happened at home and they had to, you know, stay at home to take care of their sick children or for their mom, they couldn't go to work. Also showing how this disrupted the way work was structured, and that the way the unit was set up, how work was divided, was very company specific. So for the company, it was also very difficult to replace the workers. They had to train them themselves. It created a lot of tensions in keeping up the productivity.
Yeah, and it's also kind of speaks to the level of loyalty that the workers had to the organization. A lot of them had been there for quite a long time. There was knowledge that they knew that, they would have difficulty finding work elsewhere. And B, that they knew that management couldn't afford to let them go. And so there were several instances in the case where a very upset worker would then do some sort of a protest and then would be brought to meet with the managers and essentially talked off the ledge, so to speak. It isn't like everybody was silent, but the tendency was that there was not a lot of will to take too much risk. It was okay to voice displeasure, but very few actually made the jump to actually leave. I think during his time, and he was at the factory for 6 months, during the time, I think there was only like one or two. They tended to be very, very young members, trainees or whatever. One was let go, one went off to something else. And there, the ties to the company were not so strong. But yeah, overall, everything just sort of converged on the idea of maintain stability, stay in, and just tough it out in some cases.
I mean, obviously, this is another decade compared to nowadays, but it is interesting how, or at least the author, gains a good level of insight on the individual workers. And at the same time, there don't seem to be many sort of mechanisms to sort of preempt threats of leaving or just sort of taking a little bit more care of the workers considering the personal situation.
There is one other thing I think is worth mentioning about the layout. the layout of the shop sort of precluded a lot of social interaction, which somewhat put a damper on how much the ladies would bind together, potentially for collective action or whatever. Although there were some instances of workers who would face each other or work somewhat in a proximate setting, there were a number that were, their backs were to the rest of the shop. They were facing a wall or facing a corner, or their work was so independent that they really, Lupton's observation was that they essentially did not have much interaction with others apart from, say, the break room. And there, the break room, the social interaction in the break room, there was a lot of norms of who would sit with whom, not a lot of crosstalk among groups. I mean, it was basically those who were together in the floor had tea together. And so there wasn't a lot of big social groupings, not like we would see later in the Jay's case.
And perhaps that's a nice bridge to go into the other case.
Indeed. And this was a great contrast, because you want to talk about the setting and the social interactions and all that sort of thing. You couldn't get more opposite. The Jay's Electrical Components case, the second one in the book, this is a company that made a bunch of large electrical components. Transformers was the main product of the unit that Jay worked in. And there were even different sizes or different scales of transformers, from the extremely large to the small, which is not to say small. The small is in about the size of a human being, probably like one of the ones we might see on our telephone poles in the United States. And he talked through, you know, he went through a lot of the same details about how the shop was laid out. He was in the small unit. So he was in the unit that assembled small transformers, and it involved quite a lot of handwork. But most of the work was done with hand tools. However, sometimes the jobs would involve the use of large cranes that were built into the ceiling of the workshop. A lot of heavy work, a lot of intense work, but. In contrast, you know, he did the same thing. He laid out the shop floor, and he also showed how, say, how proximate, like whereas in Wise, Tom's unit was physically separate from other units of the factory. This one, the small and the medium, were in two sides of the same huge open area, and there was considerably greater interaction among workers on the small side and the medium side independently, and there was also a lot of crosstalk between the two units. Because they were using some of the same crane facilities or whatever to get their job done. It was, therefore, much more socially active. There were some cliques, some folks who naturally got together. There were knowledge of these cliques, and there was conflict between these cliques. They had some favored folks of managers who were known as the Blue Eyes that were given some of the more exciting, innovative prototyping-type work. And then there were the quote-unquote youngsters who were who banded together, who were a bit of a handful, I guess, from the case, who did not like the Blue Eyes, and the two groups would get into loggerheads. It was a very, I don't want to say hostile, it was a very active social setting.
I see the similarities with the Dalton study here between the two different types of managers, where we also had these cliques and the conflicts between them. You see, even when you do a very specific study, like how people behave at work is not so different across settings, I guess. Well, you know, this study is looking at why were there differences, for instance, you know, in collective organizing on the work floor. That is an interesting part, but the way, you know, we are social beings and we form in and out groups. It's a fundamental part of how we experience work, what motivates us to go to work, but also what is the source of a lot of conflict, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. And the antagonism that he discussed in the case were really centered on the foreman and the rate fixer. So just like in Wise, the case involved a rather elaborate, complicated incentive scheme on how people were paid. One of the things that made it really interesting is that, when he actually tried to find out how well the workers understood the pay scheme, they really couldn't explain it. You know, Lupton did a pretty good job of explaining it in the book. I'm 75% confident that I understand it all, but it's just amazing how complicated it was. But there were still some norms that had developed whereby people understood how to report their time and how to report their production in such a way that they were able to maximize their, well, not necessarily maximize, but say optimize their pay. And even though they didn't fully understand how the pay was calculated, that was fascinating to me.
Yeah, I agree. And two other things that stood out for me is one, how in these two settings, the way the work was structured in the first case in the garment factory, the work was structured in a way that the workers did not have to interact with each other. It was management or people in managerial roles that, you know, were doing the coordination or were supposed to be doing the coordination and making sure everything was going as it is supposed to be going. But in the J case, you see that because of the technologies, the tools being used and having to be shared among groups, it has consequences for the way the work is structured and for how social interactions on the work floor are happening around those technologies. So what is the book where we talked about Joan Woodward? So I don't want to sound too technically determinist, but it does illustrate, you know, some of the key arguments of Joan Woodward that, you know, the way technology is being used, especially in manufacturing context, has implications for the ways work is being structured and organizations operate. So I found that a big distinction between the two cases. And the other one being the assumptions of management about workers. That's another one we didn't touch upon. Because, you know, in the Y case, there is an assumption of management that the workers want to work hard. They have kind of good faith in them. And maybe, Tom, you can say more about the J case, but I feel like the assumptions that management had about the workers in the J case were vastly different from those at Y.
I'm picking up on those points because they're very, very well identified. I found it also really, really fascinating to see how the J's case created that distinction between what has been defined as sociable groupings and productive groupings, which builds into the point that Greta was making around technologies, but also I think overlaps with the observations around the layout and the freedom of movement and therefore the freedom of people to interact with others, to choose who they interact with and to form those friendships and relationships. The other point, which also Greta really well identified, was around the expectations, which to a certain extent, Lupton also correlates or insinuates that there may be some sort of gender element around how expectations are of a certain kind. In the first case study in the garment industry, where the majority of workers are female, while in the second one, J's, they are sort of relaxed, or there are alternative explanations as to why the workers do not meet those expectations, in particular around output that management has pre-configured.
Yeah, he was very careful when he talked about anything with the gendered piece to try to show, you know, hey, I as the researcher, I'm not coming in with any particular biases. Here were the biases that were understood at the time, and then tried to explain. And I think he did really well at this. That you can't look at it from that lens alone. There's so many factors associated with the particular factories in question that contribute to the differences in behaviors observed. It can't be explained with gender alone. I thought he did a really really good job of that.
And perhaps in that regard, Tom Lupton was pretty much ahead of his time, and being much more a processual scholar, you know, thinking about feedback loops, how it's not a linear model that you can draw. About like, you know, these are the factors. If you control those, you optimize performance. But the performance output is shaping the social factors at play at work. There are feedback loops involved. And I'm not sure, but I really saw like this processual dynamic a little bit more in the first case. And it felt like the J case was a little bit more like, you know, linear. I mean, it might be me because the first case is presented so clearly in advance and we already know it and we see the differences between them as you read the second case. But to me, it felt like, you know, things started to fall in place easier in the second case. Like, oh, yes. Yeah, I don't know what your impression was.
Well, I think one of the things that he laid out in the first chapter that really became a central theme in the second case and in the electrical components case was the notion of deviance from the informal norms. He uses two words. One was a tirarse and the other is a scrounger. And there's a sense that it was apparent in the first case that there was a desire or sort of like an optimal flow such that, you know, items would flow from one station to the next in an optimal fashion so that there would be, if things work smoothly, there would not be any gaps or, you know, no backups, no holdups, and no shortage of work, nobody idle. In the second case, it was much more of examples given of where there was the social punishment given to those who either worked too diligently or too fast versus too slow. And the reason why that was an issue was because of the incentive scheme. So for example, if you had somebody who worked really diligently and fast, then what would happen is that the factory would come up with this new expected time. It was called allotted time to say to do a certain job. If the initial assumption was that, you know, 10 hours was the right amount of time to do a job, and you had one of these high-speed workers getting it done in 9, then what happens? Management then finds a way to reduce the allotted time to 9, which of course then puts pressure on all of the other workers who can't work that fast. Then, of course, there's the opposite side of the scrounger, who was the one who would do it in 11 hours or 12 continuously because they were just simply slow. And then that would create other issues by which people would then be penalized for not working slowly. You know, the incentive scheme would change and that the pay structure would be different. And so then there was this constant negotiation ongoing as to what this allotted time was. And what Lupton found was that although there were time motion studies done and some other things they were trying to figure out what's the right allotted time, that whole process was flawed. And in some ways, it just came down to whatever the rate fixer decided was the right number. And then everybody had to go along with it. And this, of course, created continuous tension between the workers who had their own sense of what right was, you know, right looks like, versus what management thought right looks like. And so then you have this game, and they called it the fiddle, where it was a constant negotiation over what would be considered acceptable performance. And because of this negotiation that was ongoing, it actually created a social conditions by which workers were incentivized to kind of stay inside this left and right limit or upper and lower bound as far as what would be the acceptable effort to be put out so that nobody gets penalized for management decisions thereafter.
This was great. Sorry, I was looking through my notes. Would it be okay if we sort of brainstorm what the next steps could be? Because I feel there's a lot, and maybe we could sort of, you know, identify a couple. What do you think?
Maybe we can focus in on what his overall conclusions were in the final chapter, because, you know, what he did, he came up with several major factors that helped to explain, if we were to put these two cases together of complete opposites, you know, what is it that then drives workers, or not just drives workers, but permits workers to kind of set these semi-arbitrary lower level of performance and consider that to be appropriate based on their relationship with management. And he came up with 5. One of them, of course, was between the worker-management relationship, which was antagonistic is a little bit too strong, but it definitely was, you know, there was a desire for that separation, and it puts the foreman and others is very much in the middle of having to be kind of on both sides, which puts their lives in misery. And I think we've done several episodes, like specifically the foreman episode 33, where we really talk about how miserable that job can be. But the management worker relationship is just kind of assumed. You know, if you're a worker, you assume that management is out to try to cut rates, cut time, you know, put the squeeze on as much as they can. And if you're management, you take in an attitude that you have to squeeze, otherwise the workers will, you know, it'll be anarchy. You know, he kind of shows that there's a glimmer of truth in it, but it's kind of overstated, that it's a lot more nuanced than that. But the quality of the relationship is such that they do take the side. And then the question becomes, is what permitted collective action, because there was a lot of collective action in the Jays case, that wasn't there in Wise, you know? And so he tries to compare those two cases to see, hey, you know, there's more than just antagonism between workers and management. There are factors that inhibit internal to the workers themselves that inhibit or enable collective action.
I particularly appreciated the table that Lupton drew up on page 198, you know, for any of the doctoral scholars doing comparative case studies. I think this is like a school example of, you know, how you do comparative analysis, where, you know, when you do ethnographic or qualitative work, it's often difficult to isolate one factor as explaining everything. And you know, the nice thing of, you know, ethnographic sociological research is you don't have to do that. And what Lupton does in this table is really identifying the external factors that he observes as being different in terms of the context in which Y and workers at J were embedded, as well as the internal factors. Tom, you know, management-worker relationship was one, but he also looked at, you know, what we described extensively and discussed extensively today, you know, the social structure on the shop floor, the productive system, like how the work was structured, as well as, you know, the wage payment system. So these were all internal factors shaping the dynamics at work. But then he also identifies like a lot of external factors, like competition in the market, the scale of the industry, the stability and size of the market, the location of the industry, the role of trade unions, whether they were weak or strong, cost ratio, the types of products that were being produced. You know, to me, this really shows, and, you know, I emphasize this time and time again, and we also had a PDW at the Academy of Management about this, like, we cannot understand issues around work without understanding the work itself. You know, there is a trend in management that we have to generalize beyond the settings where we do research to have, like, analytical generalizability of our theoretical insights. But to derive at those insights, like this study, and you know, when we look at the Dalton study and some of the other classics, really shows to derive at the bigger insights, we have to pay attention to the details of the settings that we study. And we cannot just talk about like worker-management relationship without understanding, like, you know, what type of work are we actually talking about? Are they producing consumer goods, or is it capital goods, for instance?
Can I just sort of ask something just out of curiosity? Do you think he studied the two places differently? Because it feels like there's a lot of dialogues in the second one, while the first one has got a lot of sort of summary descriptions of the various people. And again, maybe I'm just looking at details that are not relevant, but I don't know. I like the dialogues. I wish there were more of them.
I think it's the price of being an ethnographer. When you do the first study, you're different than when you do the second study. And I imagine that if he did them in reverse, maybe it would have been different. I don't know. What do you say, Greta?
Yeah, that might be, but I'm also thinking about first gender. Tom Lupton was clearly an oddball in the first case, and, you know, he's just one of the men in the second. But also, perhaps, you know, the expected pace of work, like, he really had a hard time keeping up in the first setting. you know, if he underperformed, he impacted the wages of all his colleagues. So perhaps he just didn't have the time to write up all the quotes and to write his field notes during data collection. And perhaps in the other setting, you know, they collectively managed to reduce the pace of work a little bit. So they had some slack time where he could go to the toilet and write up like the juicy quotes.
Yeah, it was very clear that his role in the second case was not as intense as the first one.
Yeah
that's an excellent point.
So this might perhaps be a nice thing to discuss in part two, you know, when you do ethnography, like what role do you take in an organization? Do you actively take on a job role? And how does that impact how people position you and what data you collect? Or are you like the independent observer? Yeah, services is another good one. I'm sure we will come up with some other ones as well.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.